Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. Beautiful, beautiful sunshine and a bank holiday to boot. Is April the new August?
25.7 degrees was recorded at both Newport in County Mayo and Athenry in County Galway. They were the warmest two stations today. But as you said, several stations saw their highest ever recorded temperature in April. So it was a very warm day and certainly very unusual for this time of year. For April, we've only had once before the temperatures exceeding 25 degrees Celsius. And that's what we define as a summer day. And that happened back in 1984. So it's only the second time that this has happened in April.
So people walking outside who are saying it feels like summer, it actually does feel like summer.
This would be defined as summer.
Well, in Ireland at least.
Drive Time on Wednesday with Linda Hughes of Met Éireann. And it was a record breaker. Absolutely gorgeous. But we're getting quite a lot of record breakers.
I feel like every time we look around, there's new records being broken with weather, whether it's the wettest ever or the coldest ever or whatever it might be. Is this a trend we're seeing of just slightly more extreme for Ireland weather conditions?
Yes, well, we do know that the climate of the world is increasing and we have seen these temperatures being broken kind of year on year, you know, recording the highest temperatures in many parts of the country. So we are seeing this trend of warmer weather. Now, we have had kind of 25 degrees broken in May, you know, fairly regularly. So it's not kind of unprecedented okay. that May we would see kind of over 25 degrees. But in the digital records, they go back to 1940. So they're kind of the records that we're looking at. So since 1940, it's only the second time that we've seen these kind of temperatures in April. Now it is the last day of April. So
yeah,
nearly
it's almost May.
It's May now, though. So dare we dream.
I know weather doesn't work like this, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. How does this bode for the summer?
It doesn't really
make any difference.
It doesn't really
all,
give us much of an indication of okay. What's, because we still have another month of spring to go. So meteorologically, we're not even near summer at the moment. So it's, you know, we can't really tell at this stage what it's going to be.
You wouldn't
like
see
for
this as, you know, an indicator of a good summer or a bad summer.
No, it wouldn't, because, you know, the pattern can completely change. Yeah. But at the moment, we can kind of tell out kind of next week, 7-10 days, that it is going to be settled. So the high pressure is kind of going to stay around. So I can tell you out that far that it's
do,
going
please.
To be
suitably cautious, but surely we can finally put the woolies away, break out the sandals, and if so, maybe shorts in the office. Well, only it seems if you're one of those creative types. Here's stylist Alexander Fitzgerald.
What about then for work? You know, a lot of people, I think, maybe going into the office today and yesterday, just, you know, not sure exactly what's appropriate.
First of all, it really is contingent on the environment you work in. I mean, if you work, say, in finance or in a legal field, maybe you can't get away with your, you know, combat shorts and Birkenstocks. Mm-hmm. But really, it depends on the field you're in. But really, I think just dress professionally, you know, don't have too much skin on display. I don't think shorts are really appropriate unless it's a really creative, creative young kind of hip urban work environment.
Culottes, what about culottes for a woman?
Oh, for a woman, I think that's fine. I mean, all you're seeing is ankle. It's not overtly sexy or overtly provocative.
Are you saying, Alexander, not to wear sexy clothes? Is that it?
As soon as I said it, I said, oh no, I'm opening myself up.
Cormac has to go straight home.
Because I'm fulfilling that criteria right now.
it all depends on your definition of sexy. Maybe not Pamela Anderson kind of style in the office, but, you know, yes, you can wear certain things. Again, look, it depends. Sorry, at the end of the day, I always say there are rules, but if you have confidence in what you wear and panache, you can pull most things off.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I wouldn't be going into a boardroom wearing, you know, a G-string and a vest.
Spoil sport. But if you were lucky enough to be at the beach in West Cork, you just might have been treated to this.
Hello, Anne-Marie Daly.
Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Good, good. What are you looking at? Ray, I'm sitting at the Warren Beach. I'm looking out onto the Galley Head.
Yes.
The sun is glistening on the water and four dolphins are putting on the most spectacular show I've ever seen.
You're lucky.
So close to the show. So close to the shore. Everybody has gotten up and run to the shoreline watching them. It's absolutely stunning.
What? Like, why? I want to be there. Beam me up, Scotty. I want to be in Roscarbery.
Absolutely. We've wintered this one out, to borrow Seamus Heaney. We can summer in Roscarbery.
There you go. Look at quoting poetry and everything.
Pure bliss. And it being a bank holiday weekend, extra vigilance on the roads if you're driving. And you might have noticed more learner drivers. In fact, over 60% more of them than there were in 2019. Here's Brendan Morgan from the Morgan School of Motoring in Skerries on Morning Ireland.
So there's more people driving, there's more cars. There's been a record number of driving tests last year at over 253,000. And there are more people available to do the driving tests, and yet the waiting lists continue to go up.
Yeah, there's additional drivers. There's 70 additional driving testers supposed to come on stream by the end of the year. That'll bring it up to about 200 testers. So we are going in the right direction in terms of driving testers, but the demand is just there all the time. Another factor that tends to clog up the system is people. There's no shows in the system. The people, there was 6,500 people didn't show up for their test in 2023. That actually increased to 8,500 in 2024. So that really clogs up the system. There are test places that could have been given to somebody who was willing to do their test, but these people didn't bother to show.
Well, why is that so high?
The reason it's so high is people are, you know, they're maybe on a learner permit. They book their test, they pay their €85 for the test, they don't show for the driving test, and they use the confirmation letter that they get from the RSA to get another learner permit. So it's a way of kind of kiting along a learner permit. So that needs to be addressed. It's not that simple to address that factor, because it could be some legislation needs to be changed in order to change that. But that could really increase the amount of driving tests that are available to applicants.
And it was this increase in learner drivers, among other things, that led the Irish Road Haulage Association to call out what they believe is a deterioration in driving standards. On Today with Clare Byrne, it's President Ger Hyland invited Brian O'Connell to climb on up into his cab as he drove from Portlaoise to Dublin.
There is a coach driver there now we're after passing by. He's driving a 55-seater coach and he has no seatbelt.
Just passing Junction 5 here now, and as you said, traffic building a little bit more. It's just coming up to 9 a.m. now, so I suppose peak traffic time. And already we've seen quite a number of incidents. There's a driver on the left there was staring at their phone while driving at the same time. The phone was on the seat on the left-hand side beside her. Phones, seatbelts. And then people just bad driving, crossing lanes, not giving enough time.
Crossing lanes. Here we have a truck driver overtaking us with no seatbelt. I'm not here to defend or try and defend the indefensible. If a person is not adhering to the law, well, I certainly won't be fighting their case. And I'm not sitting up here this morning either to tell you I'm whiter than white. I'm far from it.
I mean, we've seen a mix of it this morning. Seatbelts, people on the phone, crossing over lanes, not really looking. So that's typical of what you're seeing on a daily basis.
This is typical of what our drivers have to deal with on a daily basis. You know, really the standard of driving, as I said earlier on, especially at roundabouts, nobody seems to know how to use a roundabout.
And it was perhaps this observation that might send chills down your spine.
With the mobile phones, sure, should there be something to prevent people texting, for example? I know there is some technology. Should car manufacturers be doing more?
Absolutely. Like I personally would have seen laptops left up on the dash cars, iPads left up on the dash cars, and they're watching a movie as they're driving along.
And have you seen a big deterioration in driver behaviour in the past few years?
We have. We're just after passing a 3.5-ton open back truck with the load unsecured in the truck and the driver with no seatbelt.
So this is someone who's driving for a living?
That's correct, yes.
Scary stuff. That was Ger Hyland with Brian O'Connell on Today with Clare Byrne. And staying with driving, albeit in a lighter tone, Emer McLysett, she of What a Complete Aisling, she got behind the wheel of a Dublin bus. She was Oliver's visiting critic and she played a blinder.
You parked a bus?
I reversed it into parking space and showed Tina said, you would have passed your test on that.
Are you serious?
Oh my, put it on my gravestone.
Oh my God.
Put it on my gravestone with a little tiny bus.
She would have passed the test.
She would have passed the test.
Mightily impressive, but for her a special place in hell for people who do this.
Do you know what really annoys me as a driver? You know the white line before a
Thank
traffic
you.
Light?
Yes. Why does nobody understand?
Driving liquors.
We really are, yeah.
The white line before it, like that's so vehicles like buses can make a
can
turn.
Do the swinging most obvious thing in the world. Have they never noticed other buses? And their people go, no, I can get all the way to the traffic light.
I'm going to go up as far as I can. My nose is going to be whispering off the other cars that are going kind of perpendicular to me.
I love when the bus drivers use the full use of the horn in those situations. They go, what are you doing? I know there's nothing they can do, but it's hopefully for the next time.
Or the bus driver knows the bus isn't going to make it because some idiot has pulled up too far. But he goes to make the turn anyway and then shames them into having to do some kind of
right,
reverse.
That's right,
and he's just sitting, he or she is just sitting there going, come
some
on, Sonny Jim, move.
Buses have to do with delivery vans parked up in the wrong places.
I know.
So
and
extraordinary.
Tiny little squinchy streets.
Yeah.
And
this must be in your head when you're doing the...
Yeah.
Session.
Now, once you get into the swing of it, it is kind of... No, it's nothing like driving a car. What am I talking about?
And in time-honoured Irish tradition, she thanks the bus drivers, especially the women, the lady drivers.
I love when I get on the bus and see a female bus driver. I'm always a bit more like, hello. Yeah. Hello, my friend.
What is she
One
on
One of
about?
Me.
Because it is low. I think I've read 7.7% or something, even with the improvements.
Yeah, yeah.
There's very few women driving.
Yeah.
But it has very flexible hours. That surely
very
would be a benefit
hours,
for anyone with families.
Lots of different shifts. I was just looking at, like they said, people who drive, new drivers are kind of, you know, they're put across all different kinds of shifts, including night shifts. So there's you have to be prepared to kind of work all those different shifts. But I'd say, like, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't tempted. Like
for a career change.
Yeah. Now, I was obviously so good at the bus driving that they reminded me multiple times that they have openings. So I was like, and you know, they have the signs on the side of the bus that are like, earn €860 a week. And I'm like, that's more than you earn writing books.
Oh, no. Surely not with the success of the Aislings.
Oh, you'd think, wouldn't you?
Emer McLysett with Oliver. Now leave it to the Cool Cats on Lyric to bring us somewhere left field. This week on the Culture File debate recorded at the National Concert Hall for New Music Dublin Festival, Luke Clancy brought us an exploration of sound and in particular, silence. He spoke to composer John Godfrey about his work with the Quiet Music Ensemble.
Quiet is actually a very complex concept. It's not just about a low level of noise. I think there are plenty of other places where we routinely use the word quiet. We talk about quiet spaces, and we don't necessarily mean a space that is quiet in volume. Sometimes we are simply talking about a space of time or a room that is relatively free of stress, of things pulling at you. It's a time that we can think about not necessarily even contemplation, but simply being within ourselves and not feeling pulled at by the rest of the world. There's that aspect. I think also there's the aspect of what happens to our hearing, to our perception, when volumes become very low. And that really fascinates me more and more because something extremely interesting happens right on the edge of hearing. Now, I mean, that we know that. It's a rhetorical device because, you know, you can make your point by banging the table and shouting, or you can make your point by actually becoming sparser and quiet. the thing is that our attention does something very interesting when that happens, and we start to go out to it. Now, for me, that feels very different to the sensation when volume is above a certain level and you are now receiving it. It's playing at you. And I don't necessarily mean that as an aggressive thing. I simply mean that you are in a position of receiving, and then the volume goes up and up and up. And after a certain time, you are riding a wild horse. the sort of and the experience is being given to you by the sound, and there's very little of yourself in that. So this idea of inviting attention for me is that point of quietness where we mentally, orally reach out to the sound. And the thing is that when a sound is very quiet, you do that. And it's a very comfortable thing to do. You have to trust the sound. So it can't go loud.
From Culture File on Lyric. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Beautiful and kind of mysterious. And with Ray, Michael Harding, embracing the May, for it was in that month that something quite magical happened.
I was 21 years of age and I had got a job in West Cavan, and it was the month of May and it was a beautiful summer. And they had to move water for the cattle because it was so dry. And I used to have to sit on the front of the tractor, like on the bonnet of the tractor as the fellow was driving it, to keep the weight down because of the amount of water on the back of it. And I was doing that and I was lying over this tractor, right?
As a counterbalance.
Yeah, right. Up in West Cavan.
Right.
A man who'd been to university and got a college degree, and I'm lying over this tractor and I'm saying to myself, I have found heaven here. And it wasn't where anybody thought it was. It was in West Cavan. And it was a moment of realising that just being alive in this moment is better than anything. And I remember we used to have parties at that time, and there was a great fiddle player, Jimmy Shannon. I remember Jimmy Shannon, we'd come out sometimes from a party and it would be already dawn. So you'd be there till 4 or 5 in the morning, and inside the lights would still be on and the curtains drawn and people playing accordions and fiddles. And you'd come out to go home and the place would be bright as midday. And I remember Jimmy looking at the day and getting up on the bonnet of my car and playing another tune. And it was like he was greeting the May morning. And that to me...
You do love me. You do love me.
In those moments of May... And I've been watching this 2 weeks now. I've been watching for it to come out, and it's out. And it's the hawthorn. The precise May bush to talk about is really, for me, the hawthorn. And that today... It comes every time on the 1st of May. Like the cuckoo comes on the 20th of April. But the 1st of May, you go out now anywhere from Donegal to Kerry, Waterford to Belfast, and you'll find the May bushes blooming.
Sorry, there was this.
I hear a cuckoo.
Interrupted by a cuckoo.
And Ray was on something of a roll this week. All the wisdom distilled into some bite-sized bits. And you'll know if you tune into the Darcy on any kind of regular basis, he is very fond of a book called Meditations for Mortals.
So I've recommended your book to Sophie Ellis-Bextor, just so you know.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep doing more of that. More of that recommending, please.
Well, I have recommended to other people, which you wouldn't know them, Oliver. So there's no point.
I see.
In
right, right, right.
Yeah, borderline obsessed he is. But finally, stand down, Team Darcy. They landed him, the Oliver in question, Oliver Berkman. So, what is the book about?
I guess what I really wanted to do was see if I could write something that would actually help people, as these ideas have helped me, go from kind of knowing what it is you want to do with your life or how you want to work or all the rest of it to actually doing it. Because I found again and again with a certain kind of conventional self-help, it has the opposite effect. You know, you sort of you read something and even if you like it, you think like, oh, that's brilliant. I'm going to put that into practice perfectly. But I better wait a few months till I get a free week to really focus on it. And I've got to get all these other things out of the way first. And, you know,
yeah,
before you know it, there are no free weeks.
Too true. And this may ring a bell.
This feeling of perpetually being on the back foot, like you're just not quite there, you're not quite on top of things. Maybe the next book, maybe the next TV show about how to get your life figured out will solve it. And just that real shared sense of kind of permission to say like, oh, now that's not necessarily ever coming. And that isn't a reason to despair or sink into gloom, right? That's actually a reason to get on with the things that we care about now. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier.
Oh, all too familiar. And Berkman has some thoughts gleaned from 10 years of testing all kinds of philosophies and self-help theories. First off, embrace what he calls imperfectionism.
As humans, we're never going to feel completely ready. We're going to die with a very long to-do list of things that we never got around to doing. Like, this is all just the background state of being a finite human. So you might as well plunge in to doing some of the important, okay, meaningful, exciting things.
I'm thinking you were going about the to-do list as part of the business, isn't it? You know, you do it and you tick it off and I have to ring the insurance person, the bin is cracked, so I have to ring Panda and all those things, you know, and Sky isn't working and all that. And then you have the list and there's 10 things and you get to the end of the day and there's only 5 things done and you feel disappointed in yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's an endemic problem because that attempt to, like, clear the decks is never going to work because there's effectively an infinite number of things to come in and fill the decks. And also, by the way, the better you get at clearing the decks, the faster the decks fill up because you, like, reply to people's emails, so they reply to your emails and you end up, or whatever it is, you know, you do more things in the world, you get more things you have to deal with. Mm. I think a big part of the answer there, and I've got some practical methods in the book as well we can talk about if you like, but I think a big part of the answer is just seeing, like, this moment is never coming when you've got all this stuff out of the way and you can finally breathe a sigh of relief and say, okay, now I get to enjoy life or read a novel or whatever it is. You've got to take some of that future dream of serenity and sort of bring it into the present and just say, I've got to claim this in the middle of the overwhelm. Because if I keep fighting to get to the point where everything is done and all the items are crossed off, like, You will
That's impossible.
Die before that. You will die, yes, before that, yes, happens, just to be morbid about it.
Interesting. And by the way, dump the doom scrolling.
I think it's really important if you're the kind of person who wants to feel like you're, you know, being a good citizen and doing some good in the world, to realise that, like, it's a question of paying attention, but it's also a question of withdrawing attention and sort of picking your battles and saying, like, you know, what are my one or two causes going to be, and I'm going to give myself permission to sort of disattend from the rest, because otherwise all you do is you just sort of spend all day doom scrolling, kind of dissipating your care over too many things.
So to sum it all up in under 30 seconds,
the problem is not that you have not solved life, fixed all your problems, organized and decluttered, and, you know, the problem is not that you haven't solved that. The problem is that you think there ought to be a solution to being a human, and that life is like a problem you've got to solve. That's what leads to us feeling so sort of, you know, down on ourselves and overwhelmed and all the rest of it.
And that sounds quite...
Oliver Berkman with Ray. And on Drive Time, more thoughts and ways on how to live a better life, or at least a less harried, stressed one. They were joined by Dr. Paul Dalton, Associate Professor of Psychology at UCD, to talk about hope. And not just any hope. Oh no, grown-up hope.
when we think about hope, Sarah, it's really important to distinguish hope from what I kind of describe as kind of childhood hope. So when I'm talking about hope, you say I'm talking about adult grown-up hope. Mm. And that's different to magical thinking, to the kid who thinks if I don't walk on the cracks in the pavement, bad things won't happen. If I think about something, I can control other people. That's very, very different. And that kind of thinking in psychology is known as magical thinking. And that's supposed to end when we're about seven, the superstitious kind of thinking. So or you do hear it, Sarah, in adults sometimes, and it really irks me. You know, you hear adults who talk about finding a parking space because they put the right energy into the world, or the universe intervened at the right time. That's not what I'm talking about. When I talk about grown-up hope, I'm talking about hope that is a verb. So what do I mean by that? I'm talking about hope that is accompanied by action. So it's not magical. It's not dependent on good energy or vibes or the universe intervening. That's far too woo-woo for me. The kind of hope that I'm talking about is pragmatic. It's full of effort. It's the kind of hope, Sarah, that, you know, I hope I win the national lottery. Okay, so a really important step there is buying a ticket. Mm. Okay, so it requires action. So it's not wishful thinking. So it's really important to distinguish that, because this kind of hope involves our agency, right? Or our capacity to identify a goal and to take small steps in that direction.
However, if you are looking around at the state of the world and despairing, head in your hands, keep the faith, or rather, don't lose hope.
In terms of putting it into practice, so, you know, things feel bad, lots of bad things happening in the world, you know, it can be very easy actually to get hopeless about stuff that's happening, you know, and feel a sense of no control, helplessness and hopelessness.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
where do you get the hope out of things that you've no control over?
Yeah. And Sarah, I think you've put your finger on something really important there, because we are living at a time when it's quite easy to feel quite hopeless. But it's really important to say that when we give up hope, that we trip into despair. And when we trip into despair, we get paralysed. So if you think, Sarah, for a minute or two about clinical depression, right? So normal sadness, we'll all have periods of sadness in our lives. But when we're clinically depressed, when I've worked with patients who've been clinically depressed, the defining feature there is the absence of hope. They have given up hope. And actually, when a society gives up hope, we're in real trouble. The degree of hope that a society has will indicate the degree of happiness and well-being that that society has. So just kind of thinking about this a little bit. Right? So when we think about big changes that we've probably witnessed in our lives, we think about the Good Friday Agreement. We think about the election of the first female president. We think about marriage equality, for example. All of those social movements that brought about incredible change in the lives of people were based on hope, because people saw a possibility. Yeah.
All of which is very good to bear in mind. But if you're the kind of keep on the sunny side, turn that frown upside down kind of person, be gone, thou sweaty pox, or at least stay away from Cormac.
The uber positive, everything is great sicko that I hate to meet, because that's not reality either.
No.
I mean, that's hope, I don't want it.
Yeah, and Cormac, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because one of the real dangers when we talk about hope is that we get it really confused with positivity. And we've chatted here several months ago about toxic positivity. Toxic positivity is that belief that everything is meant to happen for a reason. Get up and put a smile on and you're going to be okay, and there's reasons here. And that is not hope, because hope recognises the pain that we're in at the moment, and it recognises possibility. So, sir, I recognise that this is difficult And I recognise that there's possibility here. Toxic positivity does not recognise that. Mm-hmm. It is the tyranny of the positive. Cormac, 18 years of working on a cancer ward down the road in St. Vincent's. And one of the psychological terrors that were inflicted on people with cancer was toxic positivity. Okay. Smile. You get on with this. It's okay. Look on the bright side. Oh my God.
That's not what, that's obviously not what you're talking about. Really interesting grown-up hope. There you go.
Wise words indeed. Professor Paul Dalton on Drive Time. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now to what might just be the shortest poem ever. From Poetry People, this offering from Newell O'Connor. Get right up to the speaker. It's quick.
On shunning housework. Life is a quick flight. I have poems to write.
Told you. She explained herself.
You can see there's a lot of space around this poem. And like, it's one of those ones that you think, will I bother putting it in? But it's important because it speaks to all those questions around domesticity and all the things that come up for women writers about prioritizing creativity and how, for me anyway, it's my safe space. It's my sanity. It's my joy. Poetry is my best thinking and settling tool, you know, all writing is. And I think it's important to, I suppose, let our sister writers know that you don't have to clean the house.
Amen to that. And with Oliver, Jane Casey. Her latest Maeve Kerrigan detective novel is called The Secret Room.
Why does Maeve Kerrigan feel like such a friend to people? Because we're 12 books in, but you could kind of pick up any one, really, couldn't you? You could start from there.
Yeah, I mean, people frequently read them out of order. And I actually think I quite like that. Like, I like people to kind of come in near the end and then work out what's going on. I think just there aren't that many genres where you get to write 12 books about one character and follow them through and have like their kind of personal life running alongside the rest of the story. So there's always the mystery, the crime, but then Maeve's problems go on from book to book.
There's a kind of a Mulder and Scully style relationship, isn't there?
I mean, I've heard it described that way. Yeah. there's a will they, won't they?
There is,
what I would
say. Yeah. I'm thinking book 12 because book 11 was the first I read. And now there's this one, and I'm going, is the question going to be answered at some point, or is it, you can't say?
I'm not going to spoil anything for anyone.
No, that's Josh and Maeve.
Yeah. Josh and Maeve.
But in the course of their chat, this little fact.
I have to ask you about your famous relative.
My famous relative.
Who I didn't believe when they told me in here. I was going, well, that's a bit of an age gap there between yourself and PK.
Pat Kenny, yes, he's my cousin. I think my dad was older. So my dad was of the generation above. And so, Pat is my cousin.
What was it like growing up when, obviously you were a kid, when Pat is everywhere?
I mean, he's always just been a lovely person to have in the family. And my sister was a very precocious child. And she used to, whenever she saw him on TV when she was very little, she would say, "The Pat." So he was
the Pat.
So he was always the Pat in our house. And he's just a great person to have in the family. Yeah.
Has he interviewed you?
He has.
Oh, he has?
I never mentioned that he was related to me, or I was related to him, I should say, until he said it. Like, I was like, I don't want to kind of make it look as if I'm going,
that's very nice.
Please pay attention to me. I'm actually Pat Kenny's cousin. No, but he said
Have you
it.
Read the new novel written by Pat Kenny's cousin?
That's what it would have been. Let's face it.
So you wait until he became big and then the news is out. What's it like? What's it like being interviewed by your first cousin? That must feel strange.
He's so professional. He's such a pro. Like, you'd never know. And he's, you know, he makes it very easy.
Does he correct you on some of the criminal terminology and outcomes of the novels? That's what I feel Pat might do.
I would always be a bit nervous going in just in case, in case I've got something wrong and he'll spot it. I know, he's great.
Big Daddy, I think is what they used to call him in RT back in the day. Makes a difference from the Pat.
Big Daddy. And with Kay on Arena, John Connolly. And is it too early to be talking about beet reads? We'll risk it.
It's funny, when writers are saying, why do you write? And sometimes we can come up with all kinds of very interesting explanations that we want to write in crime fiction because we're exploring notions of justice and empathy and compassion. And all of those things are maybe true. But the very least you can ask from a book is that if you're getting on your flight to Torremolinos or wherever it might be on your Watley's Red Barrel holiday, that the book passes that time pleasantly. Because we put a lot of weight sometimes on reading. I'm very judgy about people's houses. If I go into a house and it doesn't have any books in it, I'm thinking, oh, you're not really my kind of person. Or if I'm with someone at a party and they say they don't read, I'm going to get up and go and talk to somebody else. But actually, you know, reading is, at one level, is a leisure pursuit. You need to have a little bit of time. You know, you need to have, you can't be working down a mine and be exhausted. And so there's an element of entertaining the reader to what I do. I want the reader to enjoy the experience of the book. I want them to feel that they didn't waste their time with it. That's the very least that I owe the reader. And so the idea that somebody will keep turning the pages is, that's the base level for me. Everything else after that is gravy.
Now, The Children of Eve is the latest in his Charlie Parker series. Parker being his dark, troubled private detective. Is there any other kind? And in this book, there are increasing hints at the supernatural.
During the late 18th and early 19th centuries, we were the people who kept the Gothic alive. And the Gothic mutates in some ways into the crime novel. It becomes one of the genesis points of the crime novel. And you can see it kind of separating. You get the crime novel and then you get the supernatural novel. And they went off in different directions. And my instinct was kind of to bring them back together again. And so one of the key points of the series and what it's building up to is essentially Parker's nature. What is Parker? What is he? Because his daughter seems to feel that he is something that's not entirely human, that he is here for a reason that even he's not certain about. And I think that's the revelation the books have been building to. And it's why.
Ooh, and in publicising the book, you might have expected to see him doing the literary festival circuit. But no, he is more likely to be found in your local library, where the chat will be free.
I want to be very careful here that I'm not being too critical. It's a funding issue. I'm uncomfortable with people being charged 15 or 20 euro to go to a literary event. Now, I understand why, because actually nobody running a literary festival was making any money. And thankfully, the Arts Council has got to a point where it's encouraged people to pay writers for their participation, because for a lot of times they weren't paid. And I think that's really, really important. But when we talk about access to the arts, sometimes we talk about it in terms of creators only. How can we allow people to become musicians, to become artists, to become writers? But you need an audience. And if you're charging 15 and 20 euro a ticket, you're essentially creating a middle class audience. It has to be comfortable, well-heeled people who can afford to pay these fees. And I had this discussion with somebody who's involved with funding in Ireland for the arts, and his response was, well, only middle-class people go to these things anyway. And so you end up with, at the very least, a chicken and an egg question, or at the very worst, you have a self-fulfilling prophecy. The gold standard is Australia. The government takes the view that access to the arts is one of the things you pay taxes for. And that's not just having museums and galleries free. It's access to musical events and access to literary events. So the writer gets paid, and these events, for the most part, are free. You just have to book a ticket. A lot of the European countries do the same thing. Spain does it, but doesn't pay writers. Now, that doesn't work either, because obviously for a lot of writers, that's become an important income stream. There are writers who earn more from festival appearances than they do from the money that they receive from publishing. So the answer really is that we need to fund festivals a little bit better so that ticket prices can come down and be made more accessible. And I get there are people out there going, well, we're trying to build houses. And I get that. But there's a difference between subsisting and living. And you may as well say, well, why do we need parks? And why would you put a painting on the wall of your house? And why would you have flower beds? Access to art, access to music, access to culture, one of these things that actually makes our lives a little bit better if you choose to do those things. And so the only thing I can do is to say, well, look, the events I'm going to do are going to be events that people don't have to pay to enter.
John Connolly on Arena. And we are certainly into festival season. Wellies, wigs, glitter ponchos. Well, music festivals anyway. And it doesn't really get any bigger than Glastonbury. And controversy continued this week over Kneecap and their booking, but with an alternative take on the festival. Today with Claire Byrne. She was joined by Simon Marr, and they got into the sets that had propelled fringe acts right into the mainstream, and those surprise performances that had reignited careers.
This is referred to often as the greatest Glastonbury performance ever.
Yeah, I think it's what happens is people are surprised and the performers are just as surprised as the audiences by whatever feeling, whatever vibe, whatever it is that they get from playing at Glastonbury. And I think sort of Bowie had been around. Obviously, he had been huge in the 60s. He managed to reinvent himself all of the time. But by the time he got into the 1990s, we were in the tin machine days. We're in days where people were kind of going, is he a bit of an aging, you know, an aging icon, but still is, has he really got much to say? And then he came and he played Glastonbury in the year 2000. And even though there's 120,000 people standing, you know, standing in front of the stage, as he was doing the quieter songs, you could literally hear, you know, a hippie's pin drop.
Well, we take a listen. Yes. Let's hear David Bowie in 2000 at Glastonbury. Can you pinpoint what it is that's so special about it?
No. No, I think there just has to be something, and it has to be that collective thing. And I think we probably all learned a lot about it during COVID, where you could watch artists stream and do all of those sort of things. But it was only then when you were back in a room together, you know, a sweaty room together with a bunch of other people who were loving that. And I think it must be the two-way. It's got to be the two-way vibe that goes on. If that does it. But I always, it's a regret that I will have forever, which is that I saw Bowie round about the time, but I saw him in Tin Machine. And it was awful stuff altogether. But the Bowie of that era and the Bowie right the way up until his death, you know, 15, 16 years later, you know, really was something that everybody should experience.
Oh, regrets, I've had a few. But while, yes, you might well go to Glastonbury for the legends, you also go to hear the new stuff, which brings us to 2011 and this woman.
The style of the time was always, it has to be long-haired guys with guitars and huge keyboard stacks. So when the likes of Jay-Z came along, it's like, how can somebody like Jay-Z hold a crowd? You know,
and but he did.
And he did, yeah. And when Beyoncé came then to 2011, you know, and it was like, there's no way that you're going to have somebody who's going to be able to hold a crowd like this. And literally the palm of 120,000 people in the palm of Beyoncé's hand.
I saw her live in Dublin. She is incredible live. Incredible. Yeah. Let's have a listen. Take that, prog rock. And finally, Adele, Double Dare You Not to Sing Along. Listen, we're going to listen now to Adele from 2016. Tell us why this one is special.
I think it was just because it was so emotional. I think it was very, very raw. It was very, very real. And because she was in her encore, you know, you'd normally do the big, huge dance, you know, the massive, massive big song. But she decided to do Someone Like You as her encore. And it is just fantastic.
Thank you.
another great one that we missed.
Goosebumps, complete goosebumps from that.
Simon, thanks so much. That was Adele there you're listening to from 2016.
Not a dry eye in the house. And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week and we will finish with Future Islands, who are most definitely playing Glastonbury this year.